do not take pity, do not give mercy to the poor in Din. Now, on one hand, perhaps it makes sense, because if we've become the proper Jew that the Torah wants us to become, we are naturally going to favor the poor. That's sort of how we've been developed. And when you come to court, you have to make sure to put that aside, put all of your prejudices aside. And hopefully, maybe this is your strongest prejudice of taking care of the poor, and so you have to put that aside when it comes to court. And the text itself, I think, is careful to make sure that we're not talking about changing a general attitude towards the poor, but simply when we're in court. It says specifically, don't do it badin, in court. Shelo yachmol hadin, that the din should not have pity, al chalash v'adal b'sha'at hadin, only in the hour of din, only at that moment of making a decision, that's when you should not take pity. But outside of that, there is plenty of room to have pity. In fact, it's true. Now, there is a prohibition about favoring the Asher, and it actually takes place later in Vayikra, where this is also repeated. And then we have again in Devarim as well. There's actually four times where it talks about not favoring, twice not favoring the poor, but it also don't favor the wealthy, which I didn't include in this week's class, but maybe we'll even talk about it next week or the week after, because it's for, I would say, on one hand, it's the exact same mitzvah. It's something about being straight and free from prejudice when it comes to courts. On the other hand, it's a different mitzvah because it's a different motivation of why sometimes we would favor the wealthy. In fact, the Supreme Court Justice Goldberg, Jewish, of course, in the 1960s, wrote a very important piece about how he feels the American legal system absolutely favors the wealthy without intentionally meaning to do so. There's all these laws when it comes to bail. The wealthy can get out on bail, the poor can't, even if you're a poor innocent. So you end up spending more time in jail. When there's these roundups and you're looking to find a group of people who are potentially guilty, the police go to the poor neighborhoods, not the wealthy neighborhoods. There's another law that says when you want to have a witness, subpoena a witness, you're allowed to pay a fee, and the court will send all the subpoenas for you. Or if you can't afford the fee, then you have to apply, and the court will do it for you for free, but you have to explain why you want each witness. Now, what does that mean? It means you end up having to reveal your case ahead of time in order to get that witness. So there's a discrimination there as well. Anyway, so he says that's actually a far greater problem in today's legal system. But you're right, that they go hand in hand. And I think the motivation of not favoring the poor and not favoring the wealthy, by and large, is primarily the same motivation. That's what we'll talk about, this concern of equality. The one caveat that I would say to all this about not favoring the poor, it's very important to focus on the din, at the moment of the din. You are allowed, and if you, for example, turn to the next column, let me just see this, maybe turn the page, and we're in Mitzvah 233 at the top of the page. You'll see after the bold part, the third line, and about him it is said, truth and peaceful justice shall you rule, as this is the judgment of peace. What is the judgment of peace? So about David it states, and David executed judgment and righteousness, tzedakah, which is also the word for charity, for all his people. So what does it mean, judgment and tzedakah? They seem to be contradictory on some level. So what is the judgment that also has charity? And one could say that is a settlement. In other words, the concept of pshara, of compromise, is actually a very important principle within Jewish jurisprudence. And very often, one of the motivating factors behind compromise is to help the poor out. In other words, before the din has been given, one of the roles of the Beit Din is to perhaps lean on the wealthy. Let's say you have a case where a poor person is in business with a wealthier person, and the poor person is wrong, and therefore the wealthy person is allowed to collect, let's say, $1,000. For the poor person, that could put him out of business. For the wealthy person, he may not even recognize it, but it's his. According to law, it's his. So once the verdict is declared that he is right and he is owed the $1,000, the Beit Din is not really allowed to try to push a compromise at this point in time. Some say that you could. Some say that you're allowed to explain the value of a compromise, but you can't lean on the wealthy person to accept the compromise. But before the din is given, before, you know, all the facts have been determined, at that point in time, the Beit Din is allowed to suggest that perhaps we should find a compromise, a way that can allow both sides to have what they need. Actually, Rabbi Kimchi, I was sitting on a panel at the OU not too long ago about business and financial related matters, and he told the story of a very wealthy individual who had a worker. The worker decided to go out on his own, and they set up their cheshbon. The way they did the workers, you know, the employer would sort of front some money for him, and then he would get it back later, and the employee owed him some money, and it's something like $50,000, which is a significant amount of money, and the employee would not have been able to maintain it and keep his family and everything along those lines. And so he said that they came to Rabbi Kimchi. The employer was a wealthy Haredi individual, and he says he can't go to the Haredi Beit Din because they'll kill him, but he would go to the modern Orthodox rabbi and try to create a compromise. And Rabbi Kimchi, they spoke, and he says, "You're right. You deserve this. Everyone admits it. But look what it will do to him." And he says, "What do you need?" And they spoke about certain things that he needed, that the individual would admit to it. He'd pay $10,000. It would do over time. And it really saved this poor guy significantly. And then he told the story that when the funeral took place, the wealthy individual's rabbi was out of town. And so they asked Rabbi Kimchi to come and do the eulogy, and he actually told this story of how he had the din was that he was owed all this money, but then he took a pshara, a compromise, and didn't accept it all. And afterwards, you know, everyone said that was very nice, very nice, but then all of the wealthy individual's fellow business partners says, "Are we sure we're talking about the same person? You know, we don't really see that in him." But nevertheless, you can have compromise, but once the din is established, then it becomes much more problematic to do so. So the question is, why does the Torah go out of its way? I can understand it, why the Torah goes out of its way to say not to favor the wealthy. There's a natural tendency. Certainly the justices are amongst the elite in the community. The wealthy are amongst the elite. They have a relationship. Their kids go to school together, right? They play golf together, right? This is, you very often see people who look like you, and you have a natural tendency to understand where they're coming from. You have a natural tendency to favor them. They're required for the well-being of the society. But what about the poor? Why can't the judge give a little extra mercy for the poor in this instance? So the Sefer Chinuch at first doesn't really help us that much. What he says is, if you look still in the first source, the second time we see some Hebrew, says as follows: Shorish haMitzvah Yadua. The root for this mitzvah is well known. Shasechel Meid, that wisdom, rationality, our own, you know, proper thinking, not a Torah thought necessarily, our own wisdom. Meid b'hashvat adin. It testifies that there should be equality in law. Shedvar ru'i v'kasherhu, that this is a fit and very proper thing to do. So he sees it as totally obvious. It's a totally obvious reason why we should make sure not to favor the poor. But we all know that just because someone says it's obvious doesn't necessarily mean that it's obvious. I heard a story of a guy who went to a checkout counter, a cashier at one of these supermarkets, and he says that he knew for sure that the cashier must have been drunk. They were mumbling under their breath. They were taking forever. They couldn't get the machine to work. He feels that they were like cursing at them. And then he said afterwards, "And I'm not so sure how I feel about self-checkout at the supermarket." So what seems obvious to some may not be so obvious to others. So let's try to understand what he means by saying that it's obvious that you have to have a din in this regard. Okay, so one way I think we can uncover the obvious is to realize that this mitzvah is part of a series of mitzvot. So I brought down a number of them. Mitzvah number 79 is not to favor the poor. Skip over mitzvah 80 for just a moment. Mitzvah 81 Shelo lahatot mishpat rasha. This is a surprising one, but it makes the same point. You should not disfavor, right, when it comes to judging a wicked person. A wicked person is known, right? He has a record of being a criminal, not a good person, all these different things. When you sit in judgment, you're a justice sitting in judgment, you're not to not favor him. You're to hear the whole case and make sure that he had the opportunity to give his case just as fairly as everyone else, and don't jump to any conclusions. To not tip the judgment of an evildoer, to not tip the judgment of one of the litigants when one knows that he is an evildoer and a master of a sin, you shall not sway the judgment of your destitute in his quarrel. The Hebrew is interesting. The Hebrew says an evyon, which is a poor person, and it comes right after the mitzvah we had just read of the dal, also a poor person. But here the rabbis understand not a poor person, but a poor person in mitzvot. A person who is a sinner, nevertheless, you're not allowed to treat him any differently in the court than you would treat anyone else. So we now have two cases. A poor person, you can't treat any differently for his good. And a wicked person, you can't treat any differently for his bad. The mitzvot then continue. Mitzvah number 82. Shelo lachtoch hadin be'omed hadat. You should not make an estimate when it comes to judging, right? You should be very exact, very specific. Specifically, we're talking about a capital punishment case. And in a case of capital punishment, you can't have the witnesses say, I'm almost 100% positive, I saw everything except the moment of the murder. No, it has to be very exact and clear. Mitzvah number 83, Sholo lekach shochad, that's an obvious one. You should not take a bribe, right? A bribe, Sholo lekach hadin shochad miba'alei hadin. You should not take a bribe in any way, shape, or form from any of the litigants in the case. Afilu ladin din emet. Even if you've already decided and you're going to make the right decision, you still can't take any money. The Sefer Chinuch goes on to say, this should for habitual reasons. If you take a bribe, even when it's not going to influence your change, you may take a bribe at a time when it will. And he goes on to say that says, "Afilu zchut zakai the chayav." Even to say that someone is innocent, who is innocent, someone who's liable is liable. You should not take a bribe any way, shape, or form. And what if we could skip also to the next page? Or I'm sorry, I apologize. Still on this page, Mitzvah 233. Mitzvah 233 says that you should not distort judgment. That you should not, judge should not cause, the word they use in English is, I'm not familiar with, vitiation in a decision. Should not distort it, should not do something improper. And this is where he deviates at all from the Torah command regarding the law. Then if you turn the page, Mitzvah number 234, this is what you had referred to previously. Shelo lechaved gadol bedin. You should not honor a great person in din. That a judge should not honor one of the litigants at the time of dispute, even if he was great, honored, and esteemed, because you should not dignify the face of a great man. There were judges who used to not look at people when they would judge, because perhaps they'd be interpreted that they're looking at one person with a smile or a kindness, a familiarity, and the other person not so. So they didn't even want to take that. What you see here in all these cases is that the concern is not about truth. It's about process. Okay, it's not that truth is not important. I think one of the reasons why these laws are set up in place is because truth is key. Truth is important. If you look at, for example, the bottom of the first page, Mitzvah number 233, it's talking about all the importance of making sure that you get a righteous judgment. And then you see in the bold, one who wants to become wise should engage in monetary laws, as there is no greater discipline in the Torah than them, and they are like a flowing spring. Meaning you'll learn a lot of Torah when you act as a judge, because there's so many different details in monetary law. And so therefore you can learn a tremendous amount of Torah. And so truth is important because you can't distort what the Torah says. right? Even if you want to be kind to a poor person or anyone, you're not allowed to distort what Torah actually says. So here's an opportunity to learn a lot of Torah. So obviously you can't do any distortion there. And they also warned us against the judgment of a small coin should be beloved to us like the judgment of 1,000 expensive coins, right? It's not even because of the weight of the case that one case is more important than less. When you're talking about truth, it doesn't matter what the amount is. A small lie is, right, still the, or a small truth is just as important as a big truth. So the truth is important. But all of these examples that we've come up with show that process is very important. And I'll just give you a couple of examples of how important process is. And he says that it's rational. And I don't need to explain it. And we all consent this, because if you've ever been in a dispute, and if you've been ignored or not listened to or didn't feel like you had the opportunity to express yourself or that the judge or someone was favoring the other person for not the content of their case but because of some other reason, so you understand that that's a very bad feeling and it creates a problem in how we look at things. So Choshen Mishpat, which is on the back side of the page, mitzvah number 17, says there's a mitzvah lahashvot ha'ba'alei dinim b'chol dvar, that you have to equalize, you have to treat equally all the litigants in a case. B'tzedek tishpot amitecha, that you should judge righteously members of your people. We're on the second page. On the left side, in the Hebrew, it says Choshen Mishpat, Yud Zayin. What is Ezehu Tzedek HaMishpat? What is righteousness? It's not the truth of the case, but the procedure. Zo Hashvayot Shnei HaBa'alei HaDinim, that you should treat the two of them totally equally. Dinim B'chol Devar, in everything you do. Lo Yehei Alef Medaber Kol Tzarcho, you shouldn't let one of them speak as much as he needs to speak. Get it all out. V'echad Omer Lo Ktsar Derecha, and the other one you should say, please speak briefly. But you're not allowed to say that. You shouldn't speak to one. Lift up your face to one of them. Look at them nicely and speak softly to them. And the other one, and speak to the other one harshly. This is a great one here. One of them walks in looking very nice. They're wearing nice clothing. It's a nice suit and a tie. And the other one is dressed like in poor, tattered clothing. You say to the one who is wearing the nice outfit, we have a problem. Either you have to pay to get this other one dressed to look exactly like you, or you have to wear clothing that looks exactly like him. But I can't even, the judge says, have two people standing in my courtroom that look differently because we're prejudiced. We make judgments, right? We say it all the time. The clothes make the man. That's part of the logic behind the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. We speak a lot about how it would inspire people. So here, too, we admit to that fact, that a judge is influenced by how a person looks and that there's an obligation. In many courts in America, for example, they're not allowed to bring a criminal from the jail into the courtroom in his orange clothing because... in his prison suit, because you're already making a judgment by what he's wearing. And so you dress him up to look like he's a productive member of society. So that's the Choshen Mishpat writes this, and this he's quoting actually the Gemara in this regard. For sure, and we of course make those type of judgments all the time. By the way, that's one of the things that this article that I was mentioning about Justice Goldberg, that his big concern was that you walk into a typical courtroom and forget about the litigants, the lawyers, right? If you have the means, you hire an attorney that knows what he's doing, who's hired a private investigator to help you with a case. He's usually very competent and very, because of budgetary restraints, very often the public defender has gotten 1,000 cases, sometimes hasn't even read the case, let alone hiring public, and he appears incompetent. Whether or not he is not the thing. He is overburdened. And so none of those things were permitted in a Jewish court. The court made that when we make a decision, it has to be based totally on the merits, not on any superficial reason. By the way, just a positive words, and that's part of the motivation, I think, why you're not allowed to favor the poor. Why you're not allowed to favor the poor? Because the underlying principle is we're not allowed to be influenced by any outside determination. It's a very un-Jewish thing to make a determination based upon a person's wallet as opposed to the content of their character. That's with the poor, but it could be any type of determination. That's what these all seem to be teaching us. Yes. Well, Choshma Shvat doesn't say they have to change it, but they have to be equal. So either you got to get him wearing the same clothing, or you got to lower yourself. But the important quality, the important thing here is there's a total element of equality, and that everyone is equally heard. In fact, I came across an interesting case about being equally heard. Justice Menachem Alon, who used to be on the Israeli Supreme Court, wrote a case, an opinion in 1990, about this was, I guess, at the end of the Intifada. And in the Gaza Strip, there was a refugee camp called, I think, El Bujig, something to that effect. And in this refugee camp, there's a soldier walking the Kasbah, you know, the narrow roads, and he got lost. And then he was trying to get out, and he was in his car, and he couldn't maneuver because it was so narrow out, and unfortunately got surrounded by a mob. They threw stones at him, and they eventually just lynched him and killed him right there. And the head of the Southern Command said, this road is a dangerous road. And he made the decision that he's going to plow a whole series of stores and houses that came right up to the road so that it'd be much wider. And when it's much wider, he can control much more carefully people going in and out. And they couldn't get to him, and he couldn't get out, and all these other things. And he said, we have to do it immediately. It's a matter of safety. And he instantly made the orders for it to be demolished. He didn't fulfill the orders right away. It took a day or two. He invited down the lawyer from the IDF, as well as one of the heads of the IDF, to come and evaluate, and they made the architects, designers, made sure that when they designed the roads that they were going to open up, that it would be done as little damage as possible. That there was a large population center in one of them. They avoided that, and they tried to open up only in areas where it had as minimal damage as possible. Nevertheless, the Association of Civil Rights in Israel sued the army, and there was a stay of demolition for a day, and the Supreme Court met right away, and they argued that the army made the decision to do this demolition without hearing from the residents who lived right there, who would have had their homes destroyed, even though, by the way, the law is that they would have been compensated for their homes being destroyed. Nevertheless, they had the right to be heard. And so this case came to the Supreme Court, and Justice Alon tried to balance the rights of people to be heard versus the rights of security. And he argued, he pointed out, by the way, that we should follow Israeli law, even though Israeli law doesn't usually apply in this area, but we should try to, in terms of human rights and the like, try to be as generous as possible. And in his court decision, he actually quoted the Ramah. That's the next source, right below the Choshen Mishpat. The Shut Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, in addition to writing on the Shulchan Aruch, he also had a number of Shutim, Sheilot, and Tshuvot. And people asked him all series of different types of questions, and one of them was whether or not a litigant had to be heard when everyone already knew what he was going to say. And he answered as follows. Ulchen pshita, it's obvious. De'iv shar ledun bedvar bli shmiat ta'anat hanitba. It's obvious that it's impossible to have a court case without hearing the claims of the person who is being claimed against. Right? He's allowed to defend himself. It's impossible that that could be the case. Amar Shmua ben Achichem. Because the Torah, there's a verse that says, you must hear, and this also is related to the courts, this we hear in Dvarim, I believe, you must hear what your brother is going to say. There has to be a hearing. Yeah. Well, in this particular case, we're dealing with the Beit Din, which would be 3 or 21, you know, I mean, sorry, 23, or the full Beit Din. But yeah, so in this case, we're dealing with a Beit Din. Yeah, in Jewish law, you have that. Of course, the way Judaism developed historically is that a great portion of our decisions went beyond Beit Din. Like, for example, even this is a perfect example, where the halacha is following the shoot, the sheila and tshuva of the Rama, of one person. And very often we follow the halacha of one person when he makes a decision. But whenever we are allowed to have courts, the courts should be at least the minimum of three. Absolutely. And that's exactly what the Sefer Chinuch is talking about. Right now, we're not talking about getting to the truth. We're getting to make sure that there's due process, that everyone feels that they are heard. And look what the Rama does. It's a great proof that everyone should be heard, even when you know what they may be saying. And even though this matter is obvious and clear, we're able to learn it from the ways of Hashem. All of his ways are just, and all of his ways are pleasant. It's not just about getting to the right results. God actually goes out of God's way to make sure that it's done in a pleasant way, that's noam, that's acceptable to people. And his ways are path, are ways of peace. It begins with Adam. Right, we just read this in Bereshit. God says to him, who told you that you were naked? So, obviously God doesn't need to ask that question. God knows everything that took place. Menachem Alon says, his comment on this Ramah is, this was the first trial in the history. It was a question, a judge asking a question to hear the defendant make his case. God obviously knows everything, but God nevertheless asks in this regard. The Rama goes on and says, "V'chen similarly l'Kain, with regards to Cain, Amarlo I hevel achicha, is hevel not your brother? K'dei lishmo tanotav, he listened to his claim. Cain makes an argument. This was, according to Menachem Alon, the first murder trial. Again, God knows what's going on, but he afforded Cain the opportunity to defend himself. And if this is for a simple person, if this is for the case of Cain, where it's so clear and God knows everything, so obviously for the regular general population as well. The Kazed Darsho, Rabbeinu Zal, and similarly our sages have taught, Nimashen Amar, Erda Na Ver'eh, right? What happens with regards to Stom Vamura? God says, let me go down and see what's happening. Why does God need to go see what's happening, go down? God sees wherever it is. So the interpretation of Chazal is that God goes down nevertheless to check everything out, give everyone a fair hearing. And we learn from that, the Dayanim, Shelo Yiduno, that judges should not judge, Ad Sheyishma'u Uviyavinu, until they hear and they understand, Minei Ki'af B'dvar Shebaror L'dayan, even for matters that are totally clear to them. It's totally obvious. And therefore that we have to allow this nitba, the one who's being claimed, the defendant, to come and defend themselves. In this case, Justice Sloan takes this Rama and says, so even these Gazans who are living along the edge where this soldier was murdered, nevertheless, they should also be heard, even if at the end of the day, the army doesn't have to listen to them. They should be allowed to make their claim. We're going to decide if the army convinces us that it's a matter of security and that this is needed in order to save lives. When the balance comes to rights here or rights for safety, safety takes precedence, and we will find with the army. But they should hear first the soldiers. Now, Menachem Alon was a very special individual. I saw this many times when I had a class with him in law school. He actually then, his decision was as follows. He says, we absolutely should listen to the plaintiffs. However, the army did listen to the plaintiffs. That delay of a day or two, when they brought down the attorney, when they brought down this, they went, and there's no proof that says the army didn't take into consideration their needs, and in fact, they did so. So when he concluded, everyone sort of felt vindicated, right? The Gazans who said, we have the right to be heard, he says, you're absolutely right. That's the law. And so therefore I respect that. And the soldiers who were trying to save lives and act as quickly as possible for security purposes, he says, you did absolutely the right thing. You behaved according to Jewish law. You behaved according to, and so everyone walked out in positive. And I think that's part of what the Sefer Chinuch is getting at. When everyone buys into the system because it's fear, that's how you can have a court system. And if you don't have a court system, so then there's total chaos. It's Hobbes' state of nature, that people just do whatever they want. So you have to make sure to bring people into the system. And the way that is that you feel that it's fair. When you don't feel that it's fair, this exists in societies, they have an index of corruption. Societies that have very high index of corruption, people, there's a lot more crime than just the corruption. Because what eventually fails is the entire system falls, and then you don't trust the police, and so therefore you stop following the law, and the entire society begins to fall, yeah. So it's not too dissimilar from what we have in courts today. There's different cases, and right, different severities. So in a typical case, you go to a Beit Din of three. But if that Beit Din of three, first of all, didn't know the answer, they would appeal it, right? That's what we do today is appeal. You'd appeal to a higher court, right? And you'd go higher and higher until eventually the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, would have to make the decision. So that's one way you get to the Supreme Court. The other way, the Sanhedrin, the other way is the subject matter, meaning a murder is not determined by three. Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, speaks about cases that are monetary, that are dealing with fines, that are dealing with killing, meaning if the potential punishment is capital punishment, you have to start off right away with the higher court, not a Sanhedrin, but you'd go to a 23, which existed in each of the different cities. So there's what we call jurisdiction, right? Subject matter jurisdiction, and then also there's different ways of getting up there, but it's similar to what we have today. Good. Let's go to that idea just for a moment. If you look at I wonder if I brought this or not. When we spoke about fairness and equitable treatment, one of the conditions, the Sefer Chinuch writes, is that it has to be fast. If you turn to the first page, Mitzvah 233, not to vitiate justice, right? Not to make it poor. From the laws of this commandment, they include: one who unnecessarily prolongs the judgment is included in one who vitiates judgment. If you don't get judgment in a fair and decent time, that's considered unfair, right? If you're put into jail, bail, for a long period of time, that seems inappropriate. There's many other of these examples. What I want to sort of move on a little bit is, so we see that one argument for why you should not favor the poor is because you should not favor anyone, right? We should make equitable decisions. And as the Sefer Chinuch says, it's rational. You don't even need Torah to know this. People have to buy into the system. Actually, there was a paper put out by MIT scientists, social scientists, and they argue, they actually ask, why is it that the elite in many societies give over their power to courts, right? I mean, the truth is, why has history developed in such a way that you now can, you know, in Israel, we put a president in jail, right? In the United States, no one is above the law. And you have these cases of CEOs and athletes and famous people and politicians who are put behind bars. Why is it that the elite who could really control society gave over their power on a historical level? We understand it today, but how did we get there? If you had all the wealth and all the power and all the bureaucrats, why would you ever expose yourself to this type of danger? So he actually argues, as the professor at MIT says, it's totally rational to have a totally equitable legal system that doesn't favor the wealthy. That's what they were writing about, wealthy or poor or anyone, those with connections or those without connections. And he argues as follows from an economic basis. If you're a well-to-do person in a society, you can get out of certain things. You can get out of probably paying taxes. You can use your connections to get out of having to go to court. You can finagle and bend the system. And you have a big piece of pie, a big piece of the pie of the economic wealth of that society. You're not sharing it with anyone. You've got your control. However, most people then won't buy into the system, the society. You now, let's say you're attacked from another country, so the masses are not going to be thrilled to fight. That's why you had to very often draft them. But the masses are not going to be thrilled to fight on your behalf to defend the country that they feel is taking advantage of them. They're also not going to be thrilled to be paying taxes into the system. They're also not going to be thrilled to sort of create new business ventures if they feel that they're going to be treated poorly if they get into a fight with someone over that business venture when they go to court. And so what happens is, in those societies where the powerful are not exposed to equitable treatment in the courts, is that the rest of society sort of opts out. And then that society never grows. But we've noticed in societies that treat everyone fairly, what ends up happening is everyone opts in, right? When it comes time to war, people are prepared to risk their lives to defend that nation because they feel that it's fair. They're willing to start new business ventures. They're willing to pay their taxes. They're willing, because if there's fairness, they opt in. The society as a whole grows, and what these MIT professors did with, in terms of for me it was a little boring, but when they look at all the numbers, the wealthy will actually become much wealthier in that type of society. The piece of their pie that they control is much less, but the actual volume of that, what they've achieved, is much greater. And so he says it's a rational thing for people to want equity, to want to be treated equally, even if it diminishes a little bit. Okay, so that's one reason why we might argue. There are a number of other reasons why we might decide not to favor the poor. We could look at it for the benefit of the poor, almost like a Pros Bowl situation. You know, the Pros Bowl situation is the wealthy were not lending money to the poor because the Torah says the poor don't have to pay you back come Shemitah. So Pros Bowl comes and says, for the benefit of the poor, we're going to insist that the poor pay back. Right? So maybe there's something similar here, is that would a poor person want to be judged based upon their economic well-being as opposed to the righteousness of their cause? Might they look, sort of view it as a kindness that is actually not such a kindness? A good example, a parallel example, is affirmative action. There's many reasons why affirmative action is a positive thing. I'm familiar with the American case more than anywhere else, that it creates greater diversity, it rectifies a historic wrong. But a lot of studies today point out that some of the people who suffer from affirmative action are the people who is designed to benefit. There was a study, for example, of women who were given leadership positions based on their sex, their gender, and another group where it was only meritocracy. And then what was happened in the experiment is they would create a situation where the leader would fail. And what was interesting is men and women who were given it as a matter of meritocracy, they heard the failure, and they continued to operate as they did before. In fact, they became even better leaders, stronger leaders. They took it as a lesson that they learned and then improved from it. Those people who received not, they were told, again, it's all an experiment, but they were told, the reason why we're giving this to you is because you're a woman, not because you necessarily deserve it. When they failed at the leadership position, they stopped being leaders. They went back into their sort of shell. They weren't prepared to follow through with the project because they felt they didn't deserve to be there. And therefore, it affected how they looked at their own situation. Or they could have been, but remember, it was the same number of people. So they were able to, factor out. Correct, but there were many. But there were, what I mean to say is, it was a random sample, and so they told people, "We're picking you because of meritocracy, whether or not they were actually meritorious." And they told the people who were picking because of women, even if they might have deserved to it. But the question is, why did they pick? You know, what was your thinking? And if you thought this is the reason why. It created another problem. Another study that I read is one of the things that's happened in America with colleges is so colleges have expanded and now include, in terms of affirmative action, many people come to elite colleges and who don't necessarily deserve to be there in that regard. And again, I actually think there's many very positive things about affirmative action. But what this one study showed is that most people stay where they're at. So if there's a huge gap, for example, between Asian Americans and African Americans in terms of their GPO and their scores to get into certain schools. that stayed more or less the same while in college. And as a result, the perception that a person has of themselves is based upon their grade point average. And so what one of the wildest studies shows that without affirmative action, the number of African Americans who went on to become academics, doctors, lawyers, and accountants was actually higher than after affirmative action, even though there was greater exposure to elite universities. Because in the elite universities, they compared themselves to other people, and their grade point average was low. And so they said, oh, I shouldn't be a doctor, I shouldn't be a lawyer. Whereas those people who had the same scores went to schools that were more matched. The title of the article is called Mismatched. Were more matched where they are, actually then went on because they felt good. They went on to become doctors, lawyers, and the like, and they actually succeeded very, very, very well. Anyway, it's obviously a much more complicated social issue than just that, but perhaps it gives a little bit of a hint of the downside of judging someone favorably because of something about them other than their character or their the worthiness in this particular case. I want to look at two other reasons why this might be a problem of favoring. And again, the fundamental question is, why is mercy, compassion, a bad thing, right? Everything we've been taught up until this point in time is all about to teach us to develop, to become become more merciful. So one answer that I'd like to suggest is if you look at the context in which I gave you these laws. So you'll notice I skipped mitzvah number 80, right? 79, 81, 82, 83, they're all about creating an equitable justice system. Now look at mitzvah number 80. The commandment of removing a burden. To remove a burden from upon the donkey that is weary from its burden upon the way, as it's stated in Shemot. If you see the donkey of your enemy, etc., you make sure to help him out. And we're going to talk about this mitzvah because it's a very important mitzvah, but we'll talk about it separately. And what is the root of this commandment? If you look at the next paragraph, it is from the roots of this commandment to train our souls in the trait of compassion. That is a praiseworthy trait. This we have seen, this exact statement from the Sefer Chinuch, over and over and over again. All these mitzvot we've had is to train our souls in the trait of compassion. And there's no need to say that there's an obligation to have compassion on a person in pain in his body, but even upon one whose pain is due to the loss of money, you should also have compassion in that regard. Now this is a direct contradiction to the other mitzvot. Here you have a poor person. If you judge against him, he's going to have pain because he's loss of money. So why don't we have compassion for him in the courts? Now we said maybe because there's a need to have a equitable system for all of society. But here's another idea here I think as well. You see the Torah, if we looked at the Torah itself, the way these mitzvot come in the chronological order of the Torah. If you look at the Torah itself, the mitzvot of the court and what we do outside the court, right, they're intermixed. And actually later on, mitzvah 233, 234 that speak about, and 235 that speak about, again, not favoring anyone in the court, not to have mercy. The next mitzvah is to not stand idly by while your neighbor's blood is spilled. The next mitzvah of that is do not hate your neighbor in your heart. In other words, these are totally intermixed. And what I sort of learned from that is that you have to have a combination of mercy and justice. You can't have just one thing and just the other. That they actually have to exist simultaneously together in order to get the proper results. That sometimes, this is a famous statement in the Kohelet Rabbah, that if you are kind to the cruel, right, if you show mercy all the time, then eventually you'll come to actually be cruel to the kind. The way I understand this, just as a parent, in a very simple way, is if you don't educate your child to be polite, you know, if your child goes to a play date and they play with all the toys and they never put it away, so you think you're being kind. I'm not going to put this burden on my child. I'm not going to correct them when they're rude to someone. There's no kindness in that, because what happens is the little child is not invited back for a play date. Your kid becomes ostracized because they're not polite. They're not friendly. And so you've actually done a cruelty to your child by not educating them properly. So sometimes you have to, the word is not cruel, but you have to follow justice and mercy go together. That they're related, and you have to sort of combine them. And we see this in Judaism, obviously, all the time. I just read an interesting custom with regards to Pesach. That's a Sephardic custom that I wasn't familiar with. When we get to the 10 plagues, right, what do? You put your finger in and dip out a little bit, right? So where I was reading this was a person who grew up in Egypt. He says, we were much more refined than that. My mother would never let us stick our finger into a wine glass to take out. That's terrible. So our custom was, what we would do is the father would stand at the head of the table, and every time we'd say the plague, he would pour into a bowl a little bit of wine. It was a very big glass. And the mother would go and stand next to him, and every time you'd say a plague, she'd pour a little bit of water into the bowl. And so you did it 10 times, you had a little bit of wine and a little bit of water. And by the way, the kids would actually turn their head during this whole process because they didn't want to become contaminated by the plagues. And then at that, the mother would walk with this bowl away. Everyone would turn their heads away again. And she'd go to the toilet and she'd flush it down. The reasoning, the logic behind this minhag is that the father represents din, represents justice. Right, that's the wine. And the mother represents mercy. And in raising a family and in raising a nation, in really accomplishing anything of great meaning in this world, you need to have the combination of justice and mercy. You have to be able to mix the two. And the challenge is how much wine, how much water do you put in? Right? How much of the father, how much of the mother? You have to have both things there simultaneously. And of course, when God creates the world, we see this very clearly. Right? God creates the world, Bereshit bara Elohim. Elohim is justice. Literally, Elohim are judges. But almost instantly, God introduces the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei name, right, which is about mercy, the personal God, the God who is right in your corner, always trying to support you. And so we have Hashem Hu Elohim. God of mercy is also the God of justice, right? You have to have both of them in order to be successful. And I think there are many instances where you can understand the importance of this. And it's throughout Jewish law, the justices make sure to focus on it. And by the way, you see it in Israeli law as well. That's actually the official policy of the state of Israel. If you look at the last source, by the way, before I get to the last source, let me say one thing. The source above, Midrash Rabbah Kohelet, that is the source of, if you're cruel, kind to the cruel, you might eventually become cruel to the kind. The source is Shaul, Saul, who was told and commanded by God to kill all of Amalek, and he spared the king, Agag. He took mercy on the king, and then it tells the story shortly thereafter about Nov. If you remember, Nov were all the priests that were hiding David, and he went to the city of priests, and he killed every one of them. And there he should have given them kindness, and he was cruel. So this is the source of it. Now there's a machloket about what is the meaning of that particular midrash. One understanding, the one we've had up until now, is that if you are cruel, if you are kind to someone who deserves cruelty, you eventually will become cruel to someone who is kind. That's the source of it. But others say, that doesn't really make sense. I mean, just because you were cruel in this one instance, kind in this one instance of Agag, maybe you would be kind throughout your whole life. Why say that it would necessarily be the opposite? Or just because, what does it have to do with the sheep and the cattle? What is it? The sheep and the cattle are going to, they deserve to be cruel to them? Maybe yes, maybe no. So, what some people suggest, the continuation of the Midrash, says that it has nothing to do with being kind or cruel that this Midrash is teaching us. This Midrash is teaching us about the rule of law. Be not righteous over much, nor make yourself thyself otherwise. Shaul makes an argument to God. God, well, maybe I should spare the king. Maybe I should spare the sheep. If you see the fourth line, if the men sinned, what is the women's sin? What is the children's sin? What is the sin of the cattle, the ox, and the donkey? And a bat kol comes down and says, be not righteous over much, more than your creator. Meaning God says this is what the law is. It's not up to you to determine at this point in time whether or not the law makes sense or not. What this midrash is arguing is that the real problem is if you use your own personal judgment in this case, that means you'll use your own personal judgment in many cases. So if you use your own personal judgment in the case of the poor, where it might make sense to support them, well, who's to say that you won't use your own personal judgment when it comes to the case of the wealthy or the guilty or the whatever it is? The real issue is that you have to support, as we said previously, the rule of law and equitable treatment. So that's one understanding of the Midrash. The understanding that we've been talking about, though, is the one that I want to just continue with for a moment. The idea is that very often when you are cruel to kind to someone who deserves cruelty, you're eventually it may come to hunt you in another way. And that's the Supreme Court decisions, the final one. There's about four or five or six that we could take, but they all basically say the exact same thing. One of them was a case of a murderer who asked for leniency in sentencing. Another was a person who abused his wife, who asked for leniency because he had rehabilitated. There's a person who stole from the Bituach Lumi. All these cases of people who were criminals who engaged in certain activities and then threw themselves on the mercy of the court. And the court, the Israeli Supreme Court, did not give them mercy. And this was their explanation. This is with regards to the first case, the person who had been a murderer. The appellants all have extensive criminal records indicating the crime has become a way of life for them. Since they declared war on society, society through its institutions, among them the courts, must protect itself from them. There is no recourse other than distancing themselves from society for an extremely lengthy period so that they will not be able to cause more damage. No consideration, neither the psychological makeup of the appellants nor the suffering of their families, can stand before the overriding necessity to protect the well-being of the public, a fact which forces the court to harden its heart. Notice it. The court understands that it's hardening its heart. It's using even the imagery of Paro, but it understands that it is rejecting mercy because misplaced compassion leads to cruelty to the public. And they go on actually to quote the Midrash that we just quoted, that the Israeli Supreme Court, in this case it was all secular justices, quote the Midrash to say that if we don't lock up a lawyer, if we don't lock up a wife abuser, there's no kindness in that because it will eventually hurt many, many more people. So that's, I think, another explanation of why it's important not to favor. Right? We have to be careful when we think about favoring someone. You have to also understand that it might come at the expense of someone else, right? And in court, that's particularly problematic. In your regular everyday day of life, give tzedakah to someone, right? It doesn't usually come at the expense, right? In fact, when it does come at the expense, the Torah tells you slow down. You're not allowed to give, for example, more than a fifth of your assets for tzedakah purposes because it may come at the expense of your family, right? So the Torah, even there, has that, but it very seldom gets to that case, right? Where usually that is not the problem, in my experience, where people are giving more than a fifth of their assets for that purpose. So that's one of the things that the Midrash, I think, is getting at in that regard. By the way, I just had one more thing, and then I'll ask, who are our leaders who led us out of Egypt? Moshe and Aaron, right? Moshe, and think about this for a moment, I never thought about this previously. Moshe is Din. He's giving the Torah law, but it's translated through Aaron, who is doing it. Aaron is known as the sweetest of the sweet. It's translated, it's mitigated. So you have the two combined, the din and the mercy combined to actually create the proper results. Or think about Yom Kippur. What do we say? Asei imanu tzedakah v'chesed. Righteousness, justice, and chesed. Now, of course, most of us interpret that as the tzedakah as do with us charity and chesed. But the real meaning is do with us both the righteousness, the justice, and the chesed. That's the combination that we ultimately need. We need to balance these two things together. I just want to end by suggesting that maybe we can even say something different about mercy and righteousness as justice. Not that they balance one another off, but maybe they're even the same thing on some level. You know, I said to you that mitzvah number 80 maybe suggests that it's a combination. Right, you should alternate between mercy and justice. But maybe you shouldn't alternate between the two. Maybe they're actually, the reason why it's stuck in between there is because it really could be potentially the exact same thing. that it's not just about tempering justice with mercy, or tempering mercy with justice, that you should have the two together, but they're really actually the same thing. And there, the Sefer HaChinuch, I think, provides us an answer. You know, he didn't want to provide us an answer of what this is all about in the very beginning. He says it's rational, it's logical, everything like that. But at the end, I'll answer your question in just a moment. If we look at mitzvah number 234, I'm sorry, mitzvah 235. All right, so let me think about Pollard in a little bit, but let me finish here with mitzvah number 235, because we went over 10 minutes, but we started 10 minutes late also. So I'll try to talk to them that we should start on time the class before. Mitzvah number 235, mitzvah sheishpat b'tzedek, that we have an obligation to judge righteously. Okay. The commandment to judge righteously and with righteousness, we already spoke about this, how we have to treat everyone equally, and so forth and so on. Here, the Sefer HaChinuch then gives us a reason why we have to do it. He didn't give it to us in 80, 81, or 79, or any of the others, but here he actually gives us a reason. The root of the commandment is revealed to all as, with equability in judgment, the world is civilized. Right? It's rational, but it also enables a civilization to exist, which is what we've already said. Society will fall apart if you can't have courts. And by the way, it's all societies. This mitzvah is one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, right? When it talks about having court system, all these things are included in that, that the courts have to treat everyone fairly, meaning it's not just a Jewish concern, it's a world concern, and because of the reasons we said, that if you don't have courts where people buy into it because it's fair, so then the society is going to descend and everything else is going to fall apart. There'll be more murder, more theft, more, you know, all those terrible things will take place if you don't have courts. The courts are the linchpin of it all, and equity and fairness in the courts is the linchpin of everything there as well. But then he goes on. But if a judge honors one of the litigants over the other, the latter disputant will fare and say all of his claims in front of him. Will fare to say all of his claims in front of him. Meaning he'll give up. I'm not being treated fairly. I'm not going to make my case. And from this, the judgment will come out twisted, right? There will be bad judgments as a result. Also, that which we said about every person is obligated to judge his fellow favorably, that is included in this commandment. By the way, it doesn't mean that you favor them over the person to the next to you, right? It doesn't mean you favor the poor. Judging a poor person favorably doesn't mean you judge the poor person over the wealthy person. What it means is if the person makes the argument and there's two ways of judging, You try to hear the positive way. Now, maybe that you won't be able to maintain that, but you try to judge them favorably in that regard. But when it comes at the expense of someone else, you have to be careful. That's why, by the way, for example, you notice when Avraham has guests, right? He does the work, right? He invites people in, and then he runs and does all the work. And one of the commentaries, and I can't remember who said it, says it wouldn't have been fair if Avraham invites in his guests. They show up, and then he says, Sarah, get moving, and go get this, and go get that, and do this, and do that, and then he sit down. Because you can't, no, but he does, okay, but he, I'm saying Avraham is a full participant in this whole thing. Meaning, you can't do the chesed on someone else's back, right? You have to be prepared to pay the price as well. Okay, so he then goes on. That included in this commandment, this is the key line. It's four lines down at the very end. That it is included in this commandment is a cause for there be peace and amity among people. So it comes out of the essence of the whole intent of this commandment is to help in the civilization of people with righteousness and judgment, to bring peace upon them among them with the removal of suspicion of one man towards another. In other words, when you judge the poor without giving him any favoritism. How does the other litigant look at him? He looks at him as a fellow Jew. He looks at him as someone who is not receiving any special benefit. He can look at him as achicha, as your brother, as your friend, right? When you begin to favor any type of person, it affects how I look at that individual. I mentioned previously the affirmative action. There was another study that was performed where they asked people, how do you they described a fictitious group of immigrants. And to one group of people, they said, and now we're doing affirmative action for this fictitious group of immigrants. And the other group, they didn't say their affirmative action. And then they asked them, what do you think about these people who don't exist, but no one knew they didn't exist? And those who were told that they were given affirmative action, they looked at them in a negative way, and they actually looked at immigration in general in a more negative way. So once you say that there's favoritism, if the Torah came out and says we should favor the poor in courts, you would look at them differently. The whole purpose not to favor them or the wealthy or to any favoritism whatsoever is to create peace in the world. In other words, it's not that there's justice and there's mercy and they have to be combined. It's that justice will create the mercy of bringing people closer together. Have a good week.